Hello and you're very welcome to the first podcast episode of the newest sensation to hit the motoring world, Now You're Motoring. With Aidan Timmins, I'm the Senior Research Analyst with Motor Trade Publishers, and Bob Flavin, Ireland's answer to Jeremy Clarkson, and the man behind TheNextGear.com. On the show today, we'll be discussing a little bit about the shortlist for Irish Car of the Year, and also how to choose the right car for you. First port to call today is, it's that time of year again for Continental Irish Car of the Year 2011, and Bob has been driving a lot of these cars throughout the year, and the shortlist is, it consists of a couple of Fords, a couple of Mercs, and a few other brands along the way. But Bob, what was your biggest impression? What was the car that left the biggest impression on you this year?
Well, there's a few on the list. The list is, all respects, it is one tough list of cars this year. I mean, Ford have brought out some outstanding cars this year, as have Peugeot, and I mean, anyone on the list. I'm surprised there's ones that are missing that actually surprise me more. Ones like the Audi A6, the BMW 6 Series, they're missing off the top 10 list, the ones that are actually going to go ahead to win this Irish Car of the Year. But the outstanding car for me out of the list, and I'd still debate it myself even later, is the Peugeot 508.
Any reason in particular? I mean, everybody knows Peugeot make good diesel engines, and it's kind of, you know, it was hotly anticipated that the 508 would take over from the 407, which we can see dotted around the country. I think every county has a number of 407s. Some, definitely every road has a few parked in the driveway. But what is it just about the 508 that kind of sets it over and above what the 407 achieved?
Well, it's a bit of an everyman car. It's kind of a Swiss Army knife. So it comes in two versions. You have an SW, which is the estate version, and you have the saloon version. And either version are huge, but the SW version is particularly just a gorgeous looking car. And drives properly. Peugeot paid an awful lot of attention to the suspension system in it. So Peugeot tend to be fascinated with suspension, but they've paid attention to it and they've developed it for Irish roads. They've given it a full size spare wheel in the boot. It's a proper Irishized car, you know, for our roads.
And Land Rover's Evoque, I mean, that seems to be hotly tipped to take the award. What was your impression? I know you did a review of it and you can find that over on thenextgear.com, but in a nutshell, I mean, what is it that Land Rover have achieved with the new Evoque?
They've made what would be the most affordable Range Rover, the smallest Range Rover, and probably the most economical Range Rover they've ever made. So it's a big step for Range Rover to do something like this. And they've wrapped it up in a bling machine. You know, it's a real bling, real, got on the road with a few rings around the fingers and yeah, a bit of jewelry on the neck.
And a touch of Victoria Beckham's styling in it, yeah, as well, which the ladies will obviously like as
well. Yeah, and I've seen, well, I don't know what she actually designed. She's supposed to have designed elements, in quotation marks, of the interior, which could be a stalk on the dashboard or could be the ashtray or the back seat or something. I don't know exactly what she's done, but the interior is quite nice. It's a lovely car. It's a very, very nice car. I just don't know if it's actually moved the game on as a car of the year, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
As a car that should win overall car of the year. I don't know if it's actually moved on the car industry. I think it means the Range Rover have moved on and made something that we can all afford.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they've actually moved the car industry anywhere with the car.
And Hyundai i40, I mean, it's definitely set Hyundai, you know, it's set the cat amongst the pigeons there, because I mean, for a long time, Avensis, Passat, Mondeo had that whole market sewn up, and that's a really competitive market. For Hyundai to come in and produce something which isn't even a saloon, I know it's coming in saloon, but I mean, they release the estate version first. What does that say about the kind of cars that we're driving now?
It's everything's changed. The whole thing's gone topsy turvy. If you know what I mean, people who were at the top when it comes to car manufacturing and car sales are now struggling to keep up with people from Korea. Some of the Japanese manufacturers, not all of them, even they've kind of fallen behind, I suppose, to some degree when it comes to what the Korean guys are up to, because they're hiring European designers to design their cars, so they're more appealing over here immediately. But they're making this universal appeal. Look at what Kia has done with the Sportage. Universally appealable. Whatever country comes out in, everybody talks about it, because it's designed by a European designer and he designed it with that in mind, that whole idea. And everything Kia has done is the same, and Hyundai is on the same sort of a run. But they're not quite. The interior still kind of lets down the i40. I think for
plasticky
me,
or
it's a bit bland and black in places. It still feels very Asian on the interior.
Okay.
Whereas you look at what Kia does, it feels much more European.
And Kia are actually in the shortlist with one of their cars, aren't they? I think they have a Picanto in there.
They have two. I think the Rio and the Picanto are sitting in there as well. The Picanto is a spectacular little car. A 1 liter petrol. And it just, it's brilliant. It's an absolutely brilliant little small car, but it feels like you have maybe, you could probably put five people in it, add a bit of a crush, and it'll get where it's going. Not much horsepower, but everything else is perfect.
And that's the thing, really, that's the big debate at the moment is actually choosing the right car for you. I mean, while it might not have a lot of horsepower, or it might not be the biggest car, and certainly it's kind of bigger than they were years ago, I mean, choosing the car now, a lot of people will be looking at this shortlist and they'll be thinking to themselves, okay, well, come January or February when I go to order a new car, are these the cars that I want to be going for? And I mean, that's you're getting into all sorts of difficulties there when you're just looking at a car and thinking, ah, is that the one I should get? Is that the one I want? Because often it's not the car that you need that you buy, it's the car that you want that you buy.
People buy, unfortunately, they buy with probably 80% of car ownership is how it looks on the driveway. If you follow it, not how it drives or how it goes or how economic it is. If you can be happy looking out your window at the car, you'll probably be more than likely happy with the car. But of course, the big question is at the moment, and it's a very hotly thing, is whether you're good to buy a petrol or a diesel car.
Yeah, this is one of the major anomalies in the market at the moment. And there's a lot of people who think they're saving money by buying a diesel, when in actual fact they're either not saving anything or they're, you know, saving very, very little.
Or it's costing them a bloody fortune.
Or it's costing them a fortune.
They don't need to be in that expensive market at all.
No.
When you consider almost every car that has a petrol and a diesel variant, it doesn't matter what brand the car, it could be a Ford Fiesta, it could be anything you want. You have a petrol version, a diesel version. Diesel version is 9 times out of 10 about $3,000 more expensive to buy before you open your mouth, before you even look at the spec of the car. Just to buy the diesel version is $3,000 more expensive than its petrol equivalent. And so you're already $3,000 in the red just buying a diesel car.
Yeah, and even some of the manufacturers that have tried to close that gap, when the car becomes a used car, if you aren't in a luxurious position enough to buy your new car, you go and buy a two-year-old car, the gap could be $3,000 or $4,000 at that stage. And I mean, really and truly, you have to take into consideration your extra finance or how many miles you're doing. A lot of people don't really actually realise how many miles they do in a year. They think they do diesel mileage. I mean, diesel mileage is, I would consider anything upwards of around 30,000 kilometres a year.
Where I'd be as well, about 30,000 kilometres and above for anything diesel. Now, even takes into account the small diesels, the things that VW do, like 1.2 litre diesels,
yeah,
and the little tiny diesels that they have out there as well, which are very economical. They're not as economical, I don't think, as petrol equivalents around town. I think petrol is more economical in a town, in a city, than a diesel car. They're about the same. But those 1.2 diesels require the same treatment. They are more expensive than this petrol version. They will do better on long-haul journeys, and diesel is cheaper to buy at the pumps, but you will use about the same amount as you do of petrol if you're stuck in a town doing short journeys all day.
Exactly, and I mean, you have to consider, again, going back to your mileage, are you going to be doing enough miles to be able to recoup the extra outlay that you gave for the car when either buying new or when it was new to you, either a 2 or a 3 year old car? And the big issue really is that a lot of people now are just buying the road tax. It's something that we're talking about in the trade, and certainly I'm encountering when I'm going around the country, is that people are coming in and before they even ask about the price of the vehicle itself, they want to know what the road tax is. Is it 104 or 156? And if it's neither of those two, well, then I just don't want it. 303 is beyond the realms of possibility to be able to pay, despite the fact that they're trading in a car that they're probably paying 400 or 500 euros on already, because everybody pre-2008 bought a 1.4 or 1.6 petrol by and large. I mean, in 2007, I think 73% of all car sales were petrol. Most of those would have been, 1.4, 1.6 family hatch and saloons?
Either that, or it was a commercial Land Cruiser 3-litre diesel that some builder had, and now he wants to get rid of that one as well because it's too expensive, you know, $2,000 a year. But the market has shifted to such a degree because people are thinking that they can save so much money on tax and diesel that they'll recoup it at the other end. But unfortunately, there is other bugbears with diesels. Diesels are much more finicky than a petrol. A petrol will go a long time and still start without a service. You know, there is people who, it's not recommended, I'm not recommending this, but there is people who go out there for 2 years or more and don't bother servicing the car and it keeps going. A diesel just will not do
that. No, it won't do that. And I don't think, and maybe I'm stating a wild generalisation here, but Irish people, by and large, were not really fantastic at servicing our cars. No. We don't really tend to get the whole kind of... It looks like a waste of money because you don't really see any benefit, if you like, of it.
Servicing is not sexy.
No, it's not cool. Definitely not cool.
My car's being serviced is not something a chat-up line you can begin with.
No. but it's a point that is coming through more and more, is that people want cheap road tax. And, I mean, manufacturers are even copying onto this. I mean, you look at any manufacturer's range now and all of their cars are almost purely concentrated in band A, band B, and maybe you'll get a couple in band C, but the ones in band C are the ones that do not sell, the ones at 303 euros. Don't even bother bringing them in.
Here, yeah.
And I mean, you're looking now at a BMW 520 diesel. I mean, 45,000 euros worth of a car, brand new. The guy's going in and spending, or the girl's going in and spending 45 to 50,000 euros on a car, and they're being incentivized
because it's in
156, you know. Whereas you get somebody else who's buying, you know, a petrol Corolla, and they're paying 447 euros or 303, depending on the year.
There is a touch of Bangernomics around as well at the moment. I do read an awful lot of threads, especially we'll say on boards.ie or places like that, where you'll see people who've gone out and bought a 99 or 007 series. Because they can get it for like 100 quid.
Yeah, yeah.
Because nobody wants it, because it's got a huge big petrol engine in it. But yet, the owner knows he's getting pure luxury. He can drive around on the weekend. Okay, he's put a bit of extra petrol in it, but like the tax is negligible because the amount of car he has just bought himself for 100 quid.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I mean, when you look at the cars that people drive today, and we're looking out at a car park at the moment actually, and we just see an Audi A4 going by in diesel. I mean, there's you're pretty much every car that I'm looking at has a CDTI engine or a TDI engine.
True,
or some sort of a badge in the back which denotes the fact that it's a diesel car. But all those cars are coming from 08 and up. Everything beforehand, I guarantee, if you walked around your local car park, everything before then is a petrol. I mean, so the mentality has just completely changed, and I don't think anybody really realizes that they're not saving themselves a fortune if they're not doing the mileage by buying a diesel. In actual fact, it's probably going to cost the money in the long run.
Really, diesel should be kept for a sales rep. Think of sales rep mileage. Someone who's on the road basically every day, their job, their commute on a daily basis is a long journey every single day. That's where diesel wins. We used to be great fans of petrol in this country, and it's an unfortunate place to be because anyone pre-2008 with an older car, for instance, I have a 2006 Seat Leon at home. It's in 1.6 petrol. Beautiful car, absolutely brilliant car. And
engine from a Golf.
Yeah, it is.
You know?
And I have all the running gear from a Golf GTI, and I have the sports steering wheel and sports wheels and everything on it. It's a beautiful car. You can't buy it today in a 1.6 petrol. It's not for sale. It's in a diesel. That's all you can buy. Or you can buy the Cooper R, which is a 2 litre petrol. But no one's going to buy it.
And eventually it'll come in a 1.2 TSI from Volkswagen as well. But again, this just goes to show the point of it, is that Volkswagen have introduced this 1.2 TSI. It's going to obviously feature in all the brands under the Volkswagen umbrella, with the likes of Skoda and Seat. And people will buy it, I think. But they won't buy it because it's petrol. They buy it because it has 104 or 156 euros road tax. And again, then, the fuel type doesn't make any difference to them. I mean, if it was diesel and 156 or petrol and 156, then they'd go for whichever one is cheaper. So if the petrol is cheaper, they'll go for that. So all they want is for the cheapest car, but they don't necessarily want the best value for money. If I went into any dealer today and I asked them, and we're not poo-pooing diesels, I mean, diesels are great cars, and I mean, if I was going to buy a new car today and the gap between a new diesel and petrol was 1,000 or 1,500 euros, I'd go and buy a diesel myself. I wouldn't have any issue with it. But I mean, if I went into a dealer's forecourt today and I said, bring me to your best value car, bring me to the car that represents the best value for money, that if I spend X amount, I'm going to be delighted with my purchase, I don't think he'd be bringing me to a diesel. I think he'd be bringing me off to some sort of a petrol and saying, there's the best value for money on my court.
There is another side to it as well. You need to buy a car fit for purpose. There are people who are out there right now buying a little Toyota Yaris and they have 3 kids. It's not going to work. It just won't work. You're not going to get the kids in the back. You have to buy a car that's able to do the job you need it to do. So there's no point in buying a tiny little car if you have to go to Dunn Stores and fill up the boot full of stuff and you're carrying 2 kids in the back. It's just not going to work. You need to buy a car that's fit for your life rather than trying to fit your life around your car.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people go to the two extremes. You mentioned the person in the Toyota Yaris. There's also the person who's in the Range Rover who doesn't really need a Range Rover. You know, really, really don't need something
just because they drive a Range Rover.
And I mean, we're not there to tell anybody what car they should or shouldn't buy or do with their own money. Well, we're kind of there
a little bit, driving a big sports car. Yeah, whatever you want to do.
But it just harks back to the whole kind of, you know, I'll buy whatever I can afford, regardless of whether it's right for me or not. It doesn't really make any difference, you know. And it should. I mean, that's the biggest issue, is that when people go in to trade those cars in, they get a bit of a shock, because the cars they're looking to buy might either be dearer than the one that they were trading in, or a different size vehicle, because their circumstances have changed. Yeah. And really and truly, had they bought the right car the first time, they may not need to trade at that time, or when they're trading, they might not get as big a shock. I mean, anybody trading an Avensis for another Avensis, or a Mondeo for another Mondeo, is going to get less of a shock than somebody who bought the wrong car to begin with, i.e. a Fiesta or something, and then wants to go and buy a Mondeo. Just going to be a bigger jump.
Well, the biggest pain, of course, is if you go out and you spent all that thousands of euro on your car, you bring it home, you're showing all your family it's gorgeous, they want to go for a drive, and you realise you can't get two child seats into the back at the same time, or you realise that something's wrong. So big advice, folks, if you're going along and looking to buy a car, go to many dealers, go to a few dealers, test drive a few cars, and when you've settled down on a couple of cars and they're the forerunners of what you want, then make sure you bring all your stuff with you. So bring the child seats, tell the dealership you want to put child seats in it, and see what the kids look like in the back, and open the boot, and, you know, make sure everything's right before you buy it. Because remember, this is the biggest investment you make outside of your house.
Absolutely.
And plus, you're going to have to hold on to it for 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 years, maybe 5 years, maybe even longer. So don't just look at reliability. Don't just look at tax bans and everything else. Make sure the car is fit for what you want to use it for, what your family will expand to. Always think ahead as well. If you've got two kids, are you going to have a third one? If you've only got one child, are you going to have two? Always think about those things, because I have two small kids at home, and I can assure you those two child seats take up the entire back row of the biggest cars in the market.
And that's actually an interesting point, because you were saying that you should be going to all of your dealers, and there are a lot of people now who are, I mean, as everybody always has, bought privately, and that's an age-old, you know, battle of should you go with the dealer or should I go and buy privately. And if you go and buy privately, it could be upwards of 2,000 or 3,000 euros cheaper than your dealer, but that's the initial outlay, that's 2,000 or 3,000 euros. Then when you get it home and someone says, did you notice a drop of oil that's on your driveway? Was that from your old car, or is that your new car? You have to go get it serviced. Does it need tyres? Does it need an NCT? And all these things have to be taken into consideration.
Well, they do, because, I mean, private sale really is for people who know what they're doing. And even people who know what they're doing get caught.
Absolutely.
Regularly. Very, very regularly. But fortunately for people who know what they're doing, they usually know how to fix what they got caught on. And that's where it saves money. If you don't know what you're doing and you're out with a private sale, you can come home with the biggest lemon you've ever bought in your life. And if you don't know anything about mechanics, you'll end up paying probably what you paid for the car to get it fixed back into some sort of working order. And it's not just NCT, it's just down to a safety factor. It's just down to peace of mind. If you go along to a main dealership, any of the lads who've been around for a few years, and main dealerships are all vetted, and you know they've got a reputation to uphold. Mm-hmm. They've got premises and buildings that are permanent fixtures. So if you go in there, you see a car you like, and something goes wrong, at least you have a premises to drive back to and say, this car has gone wrong, what can you do for
it? Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, they're going to more than likely be giving you a warranty as well, unless it's something that's really, really old and you're getting a bargain. And even at that stage, there's going to be, you know, some sort of a routine warranty that comes with it, even if it's only 3 or 6 months or something like that.
There'll be something.
There will be something given to you. I mean, and like you said, you touched on it there, by saying you're buying peace of mind.
Yeah.
And that, to me, certainly, if I was going to buy a car, is pretty priceless. I don't think I'd put a price on driving out the door and knowing that if anything goes wrong, I could just drive back in again and it's going to be fixed. And regardless of what it is, you know, I know that I can go back, and I have someone there that I can deal with. I have an address I can go back to. Mm-hmm. I don't just arrive home and then say, you know, Johnny sold me a plum.
Yes.
And I'll just go back over to his house. I mean, you have no comeback really there.
No, you've not. And even the law is on, really, the law is very grey on this. There is, when it comes to private sale, it has to be fit for purpose. But realistically, it's just your word against the seller's word as to whether it was fit for purpose when you drove it away. And it doesn't matter who's there to witness it. If you're doing a private sale, you really, really, really have to be aware that there is no warranty. There isn't going to be one. Mm. It's very unlikely you're going to get any money back, even if the car was to just fall asunder down the end of the road. It's very unlikely you'll get anywhere on a private sale. It's different when it comes to even a dealership sale, and God forbid any more dealers should go out of business, but even if they do go out of business, there's still a follow-up to go along with it. You know,
absolutely.
There's still comeback, there's still a person behind the whole thing, there's still a relationship with the person and the dealer principal. You know, there's always a paper trail there belong to it, and that's very important.
It is, and I mean, a lot of manufacturers have pan-European warranty as well, so even if you're outside of the country and something happens, there may be an instance where you can go to the local dealer if you're over in the UK or if you're travelling around France or if you're going on any kind of a driving holiday. It's worth noting that, or maybe just checking, do you have pan-European warranty? I know BMW offer it for certain.
They do, and Kia, believe it or not, in 7 years. So if you could you bought a car today and sold it, traded it in 4 years' time, someone else bought it, they get the warranty.
Yeah.
And it continues on with them all across Europe. So you still end up with a manufacturer's warranty for 7 years.
Yeah, which is huge. And that's something I think a lot of manufacturers are copping onto now as well, because I know Ford were only offering two for a long time.
Peugeot's changed as well.
And I mean, that's something that now when people are buying, at least now when people are buying, they're thinking about their warranty.
Yes.
Not that, and I mean, cars are getting better, so there's not as much going wrong with them. But
they're
also...
There's not that many lemons out there at the moment.
No.
I mean, when you buy a brand new car now, you are probably looking at a car that's going to be working in 10 years' time.
Yeah. Absolutely, which is the way it should be, but they're getting more and more sophisticated, so there is a potential for things to go wrong, but the likelihood of those things going wrong is pretty slim. And when they do go wrong, it's nice to have the backup there. I mean, Hyundai offer a 5-year warranty, and most people will give you a kind of a 3-year warranty anyway, which is nice. And then when the car comes in as a trade, and even if you're not buying new, for the guy who's going in and buying his 08, there's always that year there, you know, there's always something there. There is a cushion there. And I mean, it's nice to have the first year. If nothing goes wrong in your first year of ownership and you've looked after it, the chances are that nothing major is going to go wrong in the second year. But that again goes back to make sure you service the thing.
Yeah, that's the thing. You do have to service a car on schedule. Not have to. I mean, it's sketchy, but I mean, some of the warranties do rely on you servicing. That Ford warranty, the 4-year warranty, can be extended to 5 years, but it relies on you being serviced in a main Ford dealership. Okay, so you can't just do the service yourself or bring it to Paddy down the road, who knows a bit about cars, to get it serviced and keep the warranty. It doesn't work. Same applies for Kia. Same applies for Hyundai. I believe they can be quite sticklers on the service history when it comes to that 5-year warranty. And so can Kia. Don't get me wrong, Kia can be just as bad. They can be a bit stickly when it comes to... you can imagine 7 years is an awful long time for a car. And if the service history is sketchy and something happens in the 7th year, you know, they will try and find a way out of that warranty. But it's still nice to know it's there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, well, I mean, I think we've exhausted everything that we have to speak about today.
Sure.
But if anybody has anything to that they want to get in contact with us about, we'll answer every email that comes in. That's car related, of course.
Depends on what you want to ask.
Well, that's true. You can find us on motoringnow@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at @NowYourMotoring. We're also on Facebook at Now You're Motoring as well. We'll be uploading some photos of our antics around and our recording studio, which is plush to say the least.
Yeah, very 5-star around here.
Absolutely. cups of tea rattling off. I hope it hasn't interrupted your enjoyment of the first show. Catch us next week for the next issue of Now You're Motoring.